Recording my own message for my own purposes. All societies face a common problem, which economists refer to as the coordination problem. That in order to do anything complicated, you have to somehow get millions of people to coordinate their activities. That to make automobiles, you need steel. To make steel, you need iron and carbon. To make iron, you need iron ore and coal, et cetera, et cetera. And there are basically two solutions to the coordination problem, and one of them doesn't work. The one that doesn't work is the obvious solution: have somebody at the top telling everybody what to do. And that works for very small teams, but it doesn't work on a national scale. And the one that works is some form of decentralized system where each person is deciding a tiny bit of the problem, and you somehow coordinate them so that they get the right result. And the form of that that we're most familiar with is private property and trade, the market system. And what you want for the decentralized system to work is some set of rules such that the individual interest is about the same as the group interest. Some set of rules such that when I take an action, I receive the net benefits of that action. Hence, if the net benefits are positive, it is my interest to take the action, and it's in our interest that I take the action. If the net benefits are negative, it's in my interest not to take the action, it's our interest not to. That's the basic problem. And the market and private property do a pretty good job of satisfying those conditions. If I want to use inputs, I've got to pay somebody to get their permission to use their labor or their goods or their land. When I produce outputs, I can sell them. And if you spend a semester or two semesters on price theory, you can see why the first approximation is a perfect system in which each person has exactly the right incentives to maximize sort of net benefit for the society. And the problem is that in the second approximation, it's not a perfect system, that we sometimes take actions where we either impose costs on people without their permission or provide benefits to people that we have no good way of charging for. And that's the fundamental problem that economists refer to as externalities. And the obvious solution, going back to Professor Pigou in England a very long time ago, is to say, if I'm imposing a net externality of $100, tax me $100 for doing that. Now my incentives will be right. I'm now internalizing that externality. If I produce a benefit, give me a subsidy. And that is, from an economist's standpoint, a large part of the argument for government action in the modern society. And I'd like to talk about a particular category of such things, namely issues which involve long-term effects and many effects. And the two that I'm familiar with are population and climate change. And I got into this about 40 years ago, at a time when population growth played essentially the same role in the public discourse that climate change does now. That basically almost all of the authoritative figures held that it is obvious that the world is better off if the number of people increases, that much of the reason why poor countries are poor is they have too many people, and so forth. And some of them made predictions. The extreme prediction by Ehrlich, some of you will remember, was that there was going to be mass famine in the 1970s with hundreds of millions of people dying, and it couldn't be stopped. It was not just that we have to do something. That was at one end of it. But that was considered within the range of reasonable discourse, as it were. And it was generally taken for granted that if you didn't do something serious to reduce population growth, terrible things would happen. Turned out they were wrong. I got involved because the Population Council wanted to see somebody from a pro-market side discuss this. And if you're curious, you can go on my webpage and find my article, Laissez-faire in Population, the Least Bad Solution, in which what I did was to try to actually add up the externalities. I tried to do such estimate as I could of if you have one more child, in what ways does that help other people and what ways does it hurt other people? And my conclusion was that the numbers were sufficiently uncertain that I could not sign the sum. I couldn't say whether the net effect was positive or negative. And it's with that background that I understood in the climate issue. Because almost all of the argument in the climate issue, in my view, is on the wrong subject. That mostly people who are critical of the current orthodoxy either argue that climate change isn't happening, which I think is quite implausible, or that it's not due to humans. And although we can't be certain, because climate is a very complicated system, it seems to me that the theory that temperatures are trending up in large part because humans are putting CO2 in the atmosphere seems to me to be correct physics. It's a plausible explanation, fits what we're observing, might be wrong, maybe something else is going on, but that's the best guess. And in general, I think the IPCC on the evidence overestimates the rate of climate change. If you actually look at the first three IPCC reports and you say, if you just read this report, how much climate change you would expect thereafter, it turns out that the first report, what actually happened was below their range of possibilities. And the second and third report, it was at the lower end of their range. As I remember, I've got this on my blog somewhere, I've got the calculations. But basically, I'm willing to take the IPCC projections as a not implausible guess of what's going on. I'm not competent to do a better job than that. What I think is wrong is the conclusion about the consequences. That I think if you actually ask, will climate change hurt us? The answer is we don't know. And I think of that in two ways. You can first think of it as a priori. Is there a reason to expect it to hurt us? And the first answer is no. That is to say, the Earth's climate was not designed for us, and we weren't designed for it, because the Earth's climate has varied quite a lot over the time our species has existed. Furthermore, our species evolved in a very narrow range of the Earth's climate in Africa, and we now prosper across a very wide range of climates. So it seems quite unlikely a priori that we should predict the change to make things worse. The only reason that we should predict it, the one, I think, serious argument along those lines is that we are currently optimized against our current environment. So we have built houses along the shore on the assumption the shore is where it is. We have decided what crops to grow according to what crops grow at Cerezo and so forth. And in general, if you think about it as an economist, you've got sunk costs in all of those actions. And if there is change, you're going to have to scrap some of your sunk costs. This would be a serious argument if climate change was fast. But if you actually look at what's happening, you're talking, I think at present, total sea level rise has been maybe as much as a foot over a century. So you're talking about very slow rates of change. The rule of thumb for the American East Coast is that a foot of sea level rise moves the shoreline by 100 feet. So you're really talking about tiny changes. Very slow changes, and the same thing is true for temperature. You're talking about a tenth of a degree per decade kinds of warming. It might be a problem for other species, because humans can change what they're doing fairly quickly, but trees evolve very slowly, they're not very mobile, so you could imagine that there might be serious problems. That's, from my standpoint, the biggest plausible negative effect is pH of the ocean going down, and we don't really know to what extent that will or will not impact aquatic species. So the second question then, which is this sort of getting into, is not a priori, but a posteriori, can we actually look at costs and benefits and add them up? And my view is that if you do that, you do not know whether the sum is positive or negative. Again, you can't sign the sum. And most people are familiar with the usual negative effects. They are not all that large, the predictable ones aren't. Nordhaus, who got a Nobel Prize for trying to estimate effects, and who I think has consistently tried to bias his results in the popular fashion, nonetheless basically concluded that if you only looked at the things you could predict would happen, you didn't justify anything. And that in order to justify policies, you had to throw in very low probability, high cost possibilities. And those are very much a sort of a hand-waving kind of estimate, because we have no good way of saying, is this a 1% chance or a 1 in 1,000 chance or a 1 in a million chance? But basically, warming, it's not clear if it makes things worse on average at all. Sea level rise, I think, clearly makes things worse, but not by very much. On the other hand, there are some very large effects in the other direction. Everybody talks about how warming is going to result in more people dying in hot summers, which is true. They don't talk about the fact that it results in fewer people dying in cold winters. One of the characteristics of greenhouse warming, which mostly people don't talk about, is that it is biased in our favor, because you have more warming in cold places and cold times than in hot places and hot times, because water vapor is a greenhouse gas. The more of one greenhouse gas is in the atmosphere, the less the effect of adding another. And there is more water vapor in the air, the hotter it is. All right. So that means that we would expect on average that winters will get milder by more than summers get hotter. I say on average, it's a very complicated system. You can always think up reasons for a different effect, but that's the right guess. And we would expect that things will warm more in northern Canada and northern Norway than they will at the equator. So in that sense, the pattern is biased in our favor. We lose land to sea level rise, but we gain land as the temperature contours move towards the poles. If you think about it, human occupation of the Earth is limited primarily by cold, but not by heat. That the equator is populated and the poles are not. So as you warm things, the temperature contours move towards the North Pole. Canada stops being a country 50 miles wide and becomes a country 90 miles wide, and so forth. Similarly for Scandinavia, for Russia, and so forth. So that's a fairly sizable, large benefit. Now, people will say if they think about it, but the areas that are now inhabitable are just barely inhabitable because they are areas that were almost too cold before. That's true. But the areas that were just barely inhabitable before are now a little bit better, and so forth down. So you really are increasing. And I've never seen a careful calculation of this, but I did a sort of back of the envelope calculation, and I concluded that the land gain from warming was 100 to 1,000 times as large as the loss from sea level rise. And you should get somebody to sort of do a more serious job. But this was very much a first cut at it. Furthermore, the other big positive effect is CO2 fertilization. That carbon dioxide is an input to photosynthesis. It is routinely used to increase yield in greenhouses. We know the effect. It's been very experimentally demonstrated at great length. The rough rule is that if you double the CO2 concentration of the atmosphere, which is roughly what the IPCC is predicting for the end of this century, the yield of C3 crops goes up by about 30%. There are two different mechanisms for photosynthesis. Most crops are C3, maize and sugarcane are C4. And you get about a 30% increase for C3, an increase but a smaller increase for C4. Furthermore, the second effect is that plants need less water, because when you double the amount of CO2 and you increase yield by 30%, that means that the plants don't have to pass as much atmosphere through their leaves in order to get that extra 30% of carbon, since they're getting twice as much per. Hence, they don't lose as much water by evaporation, so water needs go down. So the basic conclusion, I think, is that the CO2 fertilization is going to sizably increase food output in the world over the course of the rest of the century. So that's a big positive effect. So I think what you have are the known negative effects are first the fact that all change is bad because we're optimized against the current environment. I think that's a pretty minor effect for humans, that farmers are going to change their crop variety 6 times anyway in the next century for other reasons, and maybe only 4 times, that's enough. In places, at least in the U.S., buildings are rarely a century old. I have a house in San Jose that's more than a century old, but that's very unusual. More common here, obviously. But nonetheless, people do modify their houses or rebuild houses over the period of a century. So I think that's a real cost, but not a large one. There is a risk that any change is dangerous in the sense that there might be results we don't know about, and people are imaginative and suggesting terrible ones that could happen. On the other hand, we know that the globe has been warmer than this before. People don't generally recognize that we have been living in an ice age for the last 3 million years. The geologist's definition of an ice age is a time when there's ice on one or both of the poles. And people talk about, you know, isn't it terrible we might have the North Pole all bare? Well, that's what it has been through most of the history of Earth. The ice ages are not the usual, although there have been other ice ages before. So I don't think there's much reason to believe that Earth is sort of unstable in a way such as catastrophes happen if the temperature goes up by 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 degrees centigrade. And as I say, humans live across a wide range of climates. So I think there are costs there are uncertainties, but there are also quite sizable benefits. And therefore, I think in both the population and the climate case, not that the externality argument isn't correct economic theory, but that it depends on facts we do not know. It presumes that the net effects are negative. And I think what you can see happening in an argument like this is if you start out thinking climate change is bad,
Then when you do your calculations, you make generous estimates for all the negative effects. And you either make conservative estimates for the positive effects or you miss them entirely because you're not looking for them. So that one example, going back to Nordhaus for a moment, Nordhaus has this calculation where he says, let's think about low probability, high damage ways in which climate change might make things worse. He has never, as far as I can tell, tried to do the mirror image of that and say, are there low probability ways in which preventing climate change makes us worse? We are, after all, in an interglacial. We do not know reliably why interglacials end when they do. This one has been going for quite a long time. It could be, I don't think it's very likely, but it's as possible as some of the scenarios on the other side, that all that's keeping us out of the next glaciation is climate change. And we know, because it's happened several times, that that means half a mile of ice over where we are now standing, or where I grew up in Chicago, or a fair number of other places. It would also, on the evidence, drop sea level by several hundred feet, closing every port in the world. So that's a huge cost, and one which is very low probability, but you ought, if you're going to symmetrically say, let's allow for our low probability things, you ought to do them on both sides. And I think it just did not occur to Nordhaus that he ought to do that. So in any case, my basic argument, we could go into much more detail, is that there are sizable positive effects from both population increase and climate change. There are negative effects from both. And it is not appropriate to have government intervene unless you have a good reason to believe that the net effect is large and negative, and I don't think in either case that we do.
Well, thank you, Professor Friedman. I'm now going to open it up to questions. If you would like to ask questions, please indicate, and I'll add you to the list. But one of the things I should have said at the beginning is the rules of the lunch. I know some people have been taking notes. Please ensure that this is a private lunch so we can have a more honest and robust exchange of views. If you come to lunches like this, you think it might be tweeted or reported out, you might be more reluctant to give a honestly challenge or honestly give your view. So I would ask all you all to treat this with respect. This is a,
would you like me to stop recording?
No. You can record, that's fine.
Well, but I may put up the recording on my webpage eventually.
Okay, oh, fair enough.
Well, that can Well, but if there are people who are going to say things that they don't want other people to hear.
Is there anyone who might say something that they don't want recorded?
Chatham House rules protects everyone.
Second, you didn't take it in a polite way. That means not throwing bedrolls at me or anything, but you wish to make a point or a question. Try and keep it as brief as possible because we'll be here until 2 o'clock. And also, please introduce yourself so you can understand from what perspective you're coming. I see Christian, anyone else? Kingsmill,
It's true that in the public debates, the possibility that climate change could also have positive effects doesn't feature at all. But I thought in the IPCC models that was already factored in. I thought they were already looking at negative effects. And if so, what are you doing differently?
Well, as I say, I don't think you can actually tell what the sun is. So, given a situation where there's a whole lot of uncertainty, if you know what answer you want to get, you will resolve all those uncertainties in one direction. There are some of the IPCC stuff which suggests positive effects for the first few decades and negative effects later on. And my view, at least, I haven't gone through enough detail to say in general. I've looked at some of those things. And it doesn't look to me as though they have made an adequate effort to make a sort of fair and unbiased estimate of the positives and negatives. But I'd have to go through the current report more carefully than I have to find the particular things, whether they allow for CO2 fertilization, for example, or allow for the bias in favor of us in the pattern of warming. I should say I discovered that in a book by a physicist who died about a week ago, Freeman Dyson. He has a chapter where he points that out, that particular feature of the physics of it.
Kingsville.
I'm from carbon tracking and think tank, which looks at the energy transition from the policy market perspective. So I guess, first of all, I salute you for making this argument, which is unusual, should we say. I guess my 4 or 5 points. The first is to say, if we're going to carry on warming, is there any point at which we stop? So should we get the either with 10 or 20 maybe? My second question is, as I'm sure you're very well aware, Lord Stern has a very good critique of Nordhaus and the IEA model system, and says there are five or six very significant areas of additional risk which are not accounted for in IEA. I'm sure you're aware of that, and I'm interested in your thoughts on that. And my third point would be to think a little bit about the distribution of returns. So there are 1,000 million people living in India who may sadly no longer be able to live there because it's too hot. Versus 5 million living on the Canadian border. I mean, it's somewhat unjust, perhaps. And then the two further points, sorry, just the first is about the deaths from fossil fuel pollution and the current system that we have. Quite apart from the global warming issue, there are, as you know, 4.5 million people are dying of pollution from fossil fuels, and perhaps that's another factor that we should bring into the debate.
Yeah, I don't know that, I should say. It may well be true, but I don't know that in the sense that all such estimates, in my experience at least, all such estimates should be distrusted unless you look very carefully at how they were calculated. But I'm sure there are some people dying from fossil fuel pollution. I just don't know what the number is.
And then my final question is, this, I guess, this is a very interesting discussion. We now have moved into a world where the economics have changed quite radically in the last 5 or 10 years, and the cost of renewable energy has now fallen below that of fossil fuels. So are you suggesting we should now be subsidizing the fossil fuel industry in order to save us from the ice age?
No. That would be true only if I was confident that the effects were positive. Let me go through your several different points. Let me start with the question. Obviously, raising the temperature of the Earth by 50 degrees centigrade would have very large negative effects. But in my view, it makes very little sense to try to take precautions against events more than a century out. And I'm a little dubious about 50 years. But if you look at how uncertain the future is, I like to say, you know, imagine we were doing this calculation in 1800 or 1900. Well, we know that Jevons, in the late 19th century, thought that the catastrophic problem was the world running out of coal, and he was a very good economist. So I think we do not know enough. I have a book called Future Imperfect, in which I try to look at technological revolutions that might happen in the next few decades and their implications. And I gave a talk at Google on that book, and I started out by saying that I thought global warming was a pretty wimpy catastrophe, that I've got three different ways of wiping out the human race faster than that. And I think it's literally true. I can think of three different technologies which could develop in a way such that in 100 years there'd be no humans. I can also think of those same technologies developing in ways such that in 100 years we're a great deal richer and more powerful than we expect to be. And so I think trying to take actions now to deal with problems centuries in the future, because we're not talking about very large temperature changes over the next 100 years, or at least the IPCC's estimates aren't, is very, very unlikely to make sense. The only exception I know of is asteroid strikes, that we can actually calculate the orbits of asteroids, so it is logically possible that we might discover there was a large asteroid that would hit us in 120 years. We should start dealing with that now. But for almost all distant effects, one ought to ignore the far future and only worry about things close enough. I should say, my book, I mostly limit myself to 30 years into the future on the grounds that it got too uncertain after that. Next, I don't think it is true that renewables are cheaper than fossil fuel as a general rule. And if it were true, if you believe that, then you should be in favor of abolishing all of the subsidies to renewables that now exist, and simply let the two compete on the market. And there certainly are contexts where they are. I've just added solar to my house in San Jose. But the main reason I did that is that the local electric utility is not very reliable. They've been blamed, perhaps correctly, for some fairly serious fires in California. One result of that is that whenever the weather gets bad, they start saying, well, we maybe have to shut down for some area. And I wanted a reliable source of power that didn't depend on them. It may be the case that putting on solar also saves me money, but I'm not positive whether it does or not, even though it's being subsidized. But in any case, part of the problem, as I'm surely you know, with using renewable as a full substitute is the fact that it has to be stored, that both solar and wind occur when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining and at other times. We don't have good, cheap ways of storing power on that scale. But what is true
is that one of the many reasons not to worry about 100 years from now is that it's entirely possible that in 50 years from now, renewal will be unambiguously superior and will stop burning fossil fuel because it becomes a more expensive way of doing it. That's one of the reasons the future is quite uncertain. But I'm not in favor of subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, not until somebody can really demonstrate that the net externalities are large and positive, which I don't think you can yet do. With regard to other forms of pollution, I'm not making an argument about that, that to the extent that you have good estimates about coal burning causing problems, that's indeed an argument for having taxes on producing coal, but it's not an argument for a carbon tax, because some of that carbon is coming from natural gas, which as far as you know has much lower pollution effects. I should say natural gas also has lower global warming effects because the amount of energy per unit of carbon dioxide put in the atmosphere is a good deal higher for natural gas. The U.S., I believe, is actually one of the few countries that has met the Kyoto Agreement conditions, trying to very mildly, but because the U.S. had a massive shift from coal to natural gas as a result of technological changes opposed by many environmentalists, which made natural gas much cheaper than it used to be. I think that's answering your, I think I've gotten all your points.
I wonder if I could just jump in with a minor point, kind of follow on with Keith's question. Have you considered at what point a rise then becomes, leads to more negative consequences, if that makes sense?
No, I assume there is some temperature at which that's true.
Yeah.
Going back, your distributional point. To begin with, I do not believe that at least at the levels projected to the end of this century, India becomes uninhabitable. I think some cities in India do. I have one of my blog posts, and I'm afraid I haven't memorized the results, but I was trying to look at what places in India were ones which, at a given increase in temperature, and note that if the global increase is 4 degrees centigrade, the increase in India is probably less than that, because India is already hot, and hot places have smaller effects than cold. But certainly parts of India, at the extreme end, some of the Indian cities are going to become uninhabitable. But notice that over a century, people are going to move. So over a century, some of that Canadian territory is going to be occupied by people from India. The U.S. at the beginning of the period just before and just after World War I, the U.S. was taking 1 million immigrants a year. And I presume that Canada seems to be a pretty pro-immigrant place as far as I can tell. So my guess is that if Canada gets twice as big and if there are lots of people in India who want to leave, Canada will probably accommodate quite a lot of them. And over 100 years, you can move an awful lot of people. So I think there's a distributional effect in that sense, that some parts of the world will end up poorer and some parts of the world will end up richer. But I don't think it's true that means the people in the parts that get poorer are somehow, you know, guaranteed to die of heat stroke or anything of that sort.
I'm just looking on the list. I've got Thomas, then I've got Julian, then Simon, and then Otto. Thomas.
Okay, I'm Sorry. Thomas Renström from Darwin University. And so, just going back to your argument that climate change perhaps is not a classical externality as we think of it, breaking the first well, but pointed out is perhaps the pollution externalities, which are the classical ones that we ought to focus on. So follow up question on that is why is it the case, or why do you think it's the case that climate change has got so much attention where the first weather theorem, not necessarily rakes, but where the first weather theorem breaks, we've got less of attention?
Yeah. You know, I would say that climate change is a classical externality. We just don't know the sign of it. But I guess the answer, there's some quote from Mencken I can't give you exactly, about how I think he puts it in terms of politicians, but it's true more generally, are always looking for some catastrophe that they can scare the population with. And I think that both population and later climate have this feature that they were dramatic things, they're big effects, they sound terrible. You know, people talk about acidifying the ocean and they don't mention that means neutralizing the ocean. The ocean is currently basic, and the change is making it a little bit less basic, which might be a bad thing if aquatic species are optimized against the present pH, but it's not turning into acid. And one of the things that struck me quite a long time ago is a cartoon. I can't give it to you exactly, but it's a cartoon done by the people who are concerned about climate change, by the other side of this argument, as it were, in which somebody is giving a speech, and there's a list of all sorts of things, and the guy in there is saying, what would it be like if we made the cities cleaner, and the air cleaner, and world better, and a long list of like five different things, in order to stop climate change, and it turned out that climate change was fake. And the point, of course, which didn't occur to the people making the cartoon, is what they're saying is, we are in favor of doing all of these things, believing in climate change catastrophe is an argument for doing all of these things, therefore the rest of you shouldn't believe us. Right? We don't usually believe advertisers when we know they're trying to sell us something. And this cartoon was explicitly saying all of these things we want to do for climate change are things we want to do anyway. And obviously it didn't occur to the people doing it that anybody might disagree about these main things we wanted to do. If you want to find the cartoon, if you go up on my blog called Ideas and do a search for cartoon, you'll find some other things first for the question of who is or isn't a cartoon libertarian, I think, which was an argument I had with some of the other libertarians. But if you keep going, you will find that cartoon, and it's a nice dramatic cartoon, and I discuss the point.
Julia. Thank you, Professor Friedman. That was a fantastic exposition of I think the kind of core problem with the way that the problem of climate change is currently conceptualized and promoted. One kind of addendum might be worth considering and have it embedded in what you said already, and that is that the solution that's being advocated in Europe and in the UK and in some other countries being implemented, that is to say, restricting the use of fossil fuel and in spite of the arguments about levelized cost of energy being lower for renewables, driving up the cost of energy, one of the consequences of that, it seems, is to almost certainly reduce rates of economic growth, as well as just the direct effect of raising the cost of energy, and these have the potential in itself to cause problems for one of the potential solutions to climate change, which would be adaptation. So adaptation entails implementation of new technologies and existing technologies to address these problems, and so bring up flood defences, and developing new crops and so on. If you raise the cost of that innovation by raising the cost of doing business in general, then you reduce the rate of technological change, reduce the capacity for people who exist now to adapt to the climate that they live in, including, for example, people in India. Richard Toll, I don't know if you're familiar with Richard Toll's work on his IEM, which is, yeah, I think, rather better than the DICE model, but he does include some of these net benefits.
Yeah, he has an old article in which he's got a map of Europe and shows the line across which above this you gain and below this you lose.
Exactly. And yet, if you raise the cost of energy, you make it more difficult for current people to adapt. There's some wonderful studies looking at the effects in the US of the introduction of air conditioning. A couple of recent studies showing that much of the decline in death from heart attacks in southern states of the US has been the result of introducing air conditioning in the US over the past 50 years. And not only, of course, in reducing death, but enabling economic activity to take place, which otherwise wouldn't take place. If Indians were able to access these technologies, both new agricultural products, inputs, and air conditioning, then the grass wouldn't become uninhabitable, one presumes. So, what does one do to communicate that conundrum more effectively and identify solutions that are more in the direction of encouraging innovation rather than inhibiting it?
Yeah, a couple of points in response. First, adaptation is superior to trying to stop climate change for two different reasons. The first is that stopping climate change is a public good problem at the national level as well as the individual level. That if one country bears costs to reduce CO2 output, the benefits are shared with the rest of the world. So you're not going to do it for good reasons. You might do it if it becomes an excuse for collecting more money or doing something else the government wants to do. It sort of is, at this point, much more a religious crusade than a practical policy measure. On the other hand, adaptation is much more nearly a private good, that if you dike your coast, that protects you. If a farmer changes his crop, that protects him. So you're much more likely to get solutions via adaptation than via control. And the second reason is that since climate change has both positive and negative effects, the nice thing about adaptation is you can keep the positive effects and get rid of at least some of the negative effects. You can dike against sea level rise and still cultivate Siberia if it gets warmer. So in that sense, there is an argument for adaptation. In terms of your general point, I really haven't thought of it mainly in terms of economic growth as a solution to climate change, but rather that if you actually try to take estimates by somebody like Nordhaus and convert them into how much worse does this make us, it's a very small effect for the length of time. That Nordhaus has a popular article, I've got a discussion of this, I'll get on my blog, in which he's asking how much worse are we waiting 50 years to do anything about climate change than doing the right things tomorrow. And he's responding to a Wall Street Journal op-ed, which was basically saying climate change is not a catastrophe that requires an instant response. And his calculation, if I remember correctly, is $4 trillion. And he puts it as wars have been fought for less. But then you think a minute and you say, wait a minute, that's $4 trillion spread out of the entire globe in over a century or so. And as I remember, it works out to be, I think, a little under a tenth of a percent of the total world GNP over that period. So you don't have to believe that it's going to slow growth by very much to be pretty sure that we'll be worse off rather than better off if we try to take actions to prevent climate change.
So on the list so far, I've got Otto, Simon, Jamie. If I've missed you, please indicate now. And if anyone wants to, I'll come, have a second bite of the cherry, please also let me know. Otto.
Thank you very much. Simon Otto from King's College London. And so I have a couple of two questions perhaps here. And so first one is this. So I agree with you that the consequentialist somehow positive positive and negative results seems to be the right course of action here, and I completely agree that it's been largely neglected. And certainly the balance is out of whack in the discussion. But I do worry that there might be an asymmetry between the estimation of the dangers of the low probability, high impact risk in terms of the negative and the positive sides of the equation. So certainly in terms of the sort of simple solutions to climate change, the sort of things that economists can agree are pretty decent solutions. I mean, at least that the worst case scenario for those I believe there are reasons to believe that those would be less catastrophic than the corresponding low probability, high impact effects on the negative side. I'm sorry, that's not clear.
No, it's clear. It's just not clear to me. It's true.
Okay, that's fair. Let me get my second point as well. So the second point is about preferences and about, it might be that people just have irrational but deep preferences for the current climate, in which case, they might prefer, for example, Norwegians. I'm from Finland. And so I think a lot of Finns would prefer to live in a cold country, even though if they might not want to live in a cold country, but they have attachments to it and so on. So I think a lot of people might have attachments that suggest that if we want to respect those preferences, then we want to kind of stop change, even if it would lead to a better outcome.
But notice that the people who are alive and experiencing climate 100 years from now haven't been born yet. You're talking about a very small change, in which somebody who is born today experiences the climate starting now, and that's what he's getting. And we're talking about very, very slow changes. So that, do you really think that Finland would be very different if it was 3 degrees warmer centigrade?
Yes.
All right.
The winds are.
You want to have some evidence in the following sense. I assume that you have harsh winters and mild winters. And I realize that fins are protected against harsh winters by the antifreeze that they consume in large quantities, in my experience having visited Finland. But nonetheless, when there is a mild winter, is the usual response of the fins, this is terrible?
Yes.
It is. That's interesting.
I mean, we had a really mild winter now, and people are like really crying over it.
Huh. Yeah. And what about when there's an unusually harsh winter? Are they in favor of that or not?
We haven't had one in a long, long time. But, we've had a +2 degrees change in Celsius in the past couple of years. And because, as you indicated,
yes,
change can be...
That's right. It'd be larger for you. Larger for you, less smaller for India. Yep. But on your first point, I can't think of any negative effect of as high a probability as the next glaciation. All right, that we know that glaciations happen. This is a very reliable, well-established phenomenon. We know that this interglacial has lasted for a long time, that by geological standards, we should be about due. Now, about due means, you know, sometime in the next 10,000 years. It's not a high probability thing. But nonetheless, everything else being equal, stopping warming makes us more likely to have a glaciation. And I don't think I've seen any very plausible negative things that are as serious as ice, as glaciers moving down, half a mile of ice over London, 300-foot drop in sea level, all of the things that which we've seen happen over and over. London wasn't there at the time, of course. Over and over with the other things. So, but in any case, it's certainly possible. I mean, maybe it's very hard to do an unbiased estimate of the low probability ones, because changing something from 1% to 0.1% has a huge effect, but nobody really knows for any of those. And I don't think Nordhaus knows if you look at it. So in any case, all I can say is you could be correct, but I don't see any particular reason to think you're correct to that. And you may be right that some people in cold places would really rather, I mean, I grew up in Chicago and I'd rather have it warmer, but not in the summer. But then I wasn't in Chicago in the summer when I could help it.
I think you also neglect the effect that some people just like to complain.
Yep.
In London we complain about the cold weather on days like this. In the summer we complain about it being too hot. Yeah.
I wanted to get back to the air conditioning just for a moment, because I should report that my father thought the invention of air conditioning was a catastrophe because it made it possible for the government in D.C. to run all year round, whereas it used to be the case that D.C. was uninhabitable in the summer.
And just so those of you who are aware, David's father was Bill Gilbert Friedman. So I've got Simon Kay next, and then I've got Jamie, and then Massimiliano, and that should take us up to 2 o'clock. Simon.
Thank you so much for your interesting comments. I'm Simon Kay. I'm a recovering academic, now working in think tanks, Eleanor Ostrom. So I'm interested in sort of the extent to which, and I think I'm following up a little bit on the sort of things Ostrom was saying, the extent to which we think there are alternative justifications to government and state action in it, some of which can't be captured by cost-benefit analysis the way that you're doing it. Mm-hmm. So for example, I think it's pretty well established that human beings tend to be risk-averse. So the downside risks that you describe and say, well, they might be compensated for or similarly probable to upside, people might be interested in avoiding them to such an extent that they direct their governments to intervene in certain ways, and I wonder to what extent you think that's justifiable, even setting that aside. There's an inequality question that I think was raised earlier. Certainly in global inequality terms, there's going to be more access to the upside because people are already enjoying certain degrees of benefits and privilege in the global society. There's going to be less, there's going to be more impact to the downsides, to people who are disbenefited by the current system. So isn't climate change, if nothing else, in risk aversion terms, an argument for more global equality? And what are the best mechanisms for achieving that? Certainly there's some argument that the state has a role there. And even setting that aside, there are some people who would want to say, you're dismissing the welfare of the animal kingdom, of the environment itself. There's a deep green ecological point to make here, that there's a potential intrinsic value to the environment that we occupy, and that in itself, even if we could reliably say there's no real risk to humans in our societies, that's justification enough for government intervention.
I certainly think that risk aversion ought to be taken account in trying to do cost-benefit analysis, but it is not at all clear to me that cuts the way you want it to cut, because, you know, as I say, I haven't done extensive research, but I have described one way at least in which you could have a really big catastrophe from stopping global warming. With regard to the inequality effect, you might notice the curious fact that all of the countries that are taking actions to cut down CO2 are rich countries, and that the countries where getting cheap power really matters are precisely the countries that you're worried about, places like India. And for some odd reason, India keeps building coal burning facilities. So that if, as I think is probably the case, the method, if you want to really control CO2 output, you are going to do it by imposing very large costs on poor countries, then your argument cuts in the opposite direction of the way you want it to cut. Beyond that, it seems to me that whatever people may say, I don't see much evidence that people in rich countries care much about global inequality. They may care about local inequality. But I have yet to hear any American left-wingers, Bernie Sanders say that the U.S. ought to be taxing all Americans, rich and poor, in order to send the money to India. But if you take seriously, furthermore, Bernie Sanders is against immigration. All right? Immigration is the obvious way in which the U.S. at a relatively low cost to itself could make life better for millions or tens of millions of poor people. So what do? We devote resources to keeping them out. So it just seems to me that if anything, I mean, in terms of moral philosophy, I'm not disagreeing with the argument. You can certainly say that, I mean, they're very complicated. I don't think it's clear that there's a good case for equality, but certainly many people believe it, and it's not clear that there isn't. But insofar as there is, I don't think it's a plausible argument to give to any real-world governments. And I think that's getting much more towards religion, and the problem is that when you're doing things because they sort of feel good, you are not likely to think very carefully about their real consequences.
Very interesting, I think, also when you think about some of these things and upside and downside, some of the work that people like Kahneman and Ariely have done on this, you know, the trade-offs between the downside and the upside and people's sort of boundary rationality, as it were. We've got time for two more questions. And if I may ask you two one after the other, and then you could try and answer both. Jamie, and then Matthew Milano.
So, similar to the family saying, along the kind of political effects that global warming could not have. I know it's hard to kind of quantify the costs and benefits, especially after, say, like 50 years, as you say. But is there not an argument, I'm playing kind of devil's advocate, I don't necessarily agree with it, but is there not an argument that you could kind of quantify or predict the chance of there being kind of political upset and the rise of kind of extremism with what we've seen with like the migrant crisis and, you know, European countries being less kind of inclusive with accepting migrants? Do you not think that rate could kind of increase and therefore actually bring about kind of political change where they're not necessarily...
I don't see any particular reason to expect that to happen. You would expect that countries which become larger because of warming are going to be more willing to accept immigrants than they were before, since they're going to have more free land, as it were, which they'd like to populate and tax. I would say what would bother me in the political issue is on the other side, and that is that if you were really serious about keeping down CO2, you're going to require a world government or some equivalent. We would have to be willing to say to India, we will drop bombs on you or we'll do something evil to you if you don't stop burning coal. That strikes me as a very unattractive situation for world politics. That my view essentially is that because it's a global public good problem, that if it were a catastrophic problem, the only real solution would be world government, then that strikes me as a cure that's worse than the disease. I discussed this a little bit in my book, Future Imperfect, where what I'm saying is that there might be future problems that are not curable. And that if global warming were really the sort of very serious thing people think it is, then that might be in that category, that it's one for which there is no solution.
My question is, assuming that we can prove that the negative effects outweigh the positive effect, or even assuming that the action bias is just too strong to rely on individual adaptation. Have you given any thought to the idea of geoengineering, so the idea of voluntarily...
Yeah. There's one of the things that's noticeable in terms of the controversy, not the science, is the degree to which the people who are worried about climate change are against geoengineering.
and in fact try to block experiments on geoengineering. And I don't know whether geoengineering would work or not, but certainly if one believes that climate change is a real problem, one ought to at least think about that. But there's also, again, the hard problem that you're taking actions that affect the world. We don't have a world government to do it, fortunately, and any given country, you take some action. You know, if countries were more rational, which they aren't, then every time you try to do geoengineering, the Scandinavians would shoot it down because it's too cold there. Or the Russians, that's right. Well, the Russians are a good case because, as far as I can tell, Putin claims not to believe in global warming. And my theory is he believes it and has correctly done the calculations.
That Russia's the winner.
No, it's one of the big winners. It's not the only one, but I think it is. Russia does not have very much territory that's really hot. And it has quite a lot of territory that's uncomfortably cold.
So before I bring the full proceedings to a close, and please do stay around as long as you want to do partake of cheese and crackers before we run out. People did predict before Brexit we were going to run out of all this stuff. And they were wrong, so maybe let's do other predictions. First, a couple of adverts. In front of you, you'll see two publications. One is Economic Affairs, which is our more academic journal. EA is our more accessible journal. Interestingly, in there you will find an article by a very modest chap.